Can you remember about Milarepa's life? Something about it. There he was, persecuted and aggrieved by his relatives, basically living as a slave, seeing his mother and his sister suffering very seriously, until eventually his mother sent him off to learn sorcery, and he wreaks his vengeance, or the horses do, and the house collapses, and most of his relatives and his enemies are killed, 35 of them. But this doesn't really solve anything, and what it does do is make him feel intensely unhappy about himself and his actions and how destructive they've been, and this terror of the consequences of the kind of life he's going to fall into gradually over his life if he doesn't do something about this great sliver of ice that he's embedded in his heart, of hatred and vengeance, and how eventually he finds his guru, Marpa, and Marpa puts him through the 9 great ordeals, building the towers, abuse, refusing him the teachings, treating him very coldly and even cruelly, and then finally revealing what he was really doing, and how this is what Milarepa needed to melt that ice, sending Milarepa up into the mountain cave where he meditated for 11 months. He was 6 years and 8 months with Marpa, and then he was 11 months in the mountain cave, and then he had the dream of his mother's death, returned home, and was very profoundly moved, and this is what really gave him his deep insight, what we would call stream entry, took him to that point. And then a further 12 years of meditating, he said farewell to Marpa. That was the last he ever saw of him in the flesh, although he often saw him in his dreams and in his visions. And 12 years in all sorts of caves, until full enlightenment. And then he just carried on, stayed living in the caves. So I want to not so much tell the story of the rest of his life now, but give you some of his songs, some of his teachings. So I've compiled a very small proportion of his 100,000 songs into some sort of an order, and under a number of themes that I thought might be of some use or interest to you. I'll give you a handout at the end of this with the ones I'm quoting, or most of the ones I'm quoting, on the handout, so you can have a look at it yourself, see what you think, and talk about it in the group tomorrow and the next day if you wish to. So that's where we're at so far. Does anyone have any questions about what we've looked at so far that can't be handled through discussion in the groups? Yeah.
Are we going
to
sing?
Well, I would love to, but I don't know any tunes for the songs. I mean, it's made me feel that I'd like to do that. But I'll tell you the difficulty is that the translations are not in proper verse. So unless you sung in a very free Joni Mitchell sort of style, can anyone do Joni Mitchell? unless you did that, or Benjamin Britten sort of style, or whatever, I don't know what other, Bartok maybe? But then it would actually be very difficult to do it. And I think that really one would need to rewrite the songs in proper rhyming verse, because that's what, if Milarepa had been European, or at least British, that's what he would have done, like William Blake. So if you can think of a tune, then come to me and we'll talk about it. So we'll have some examples here. You'll have some examples. If you can think of a tune, one of these, then I'd love to hear it, and we'll talk about that. Same goes for anybody else. But a very good idea, yeah. And I have heard it done. I have heard people sing them. Okay, shall I carry on? Anything else? The first question I wanted to ask is, what sort of a Buddhist is Milarepa, or was Milarepa? Now, one answer is he was an enlightened Buddhist, which is the best kind to be. But in a more mundane sense, what sort of a Buddhist was he? Because if you look around the Buddhist world today and talk to Buddhists, especially outside this particular movement, the question always is, you know, are you a monk or are you a lay person? Or are you perhaps a nun? Are you a monastic or are you somebody who lives an ordinary life? So if we had to choose for Milarepa, I think it would be quite difficult to answer that question. And it makes you realize that Milarepa does not fall into those categories. But he does, he is nevertheless part of a very strong and definite tradition going right back to the Buddha himself, which is not being monastic and not being a layperson either. And the word that's usually used for what Milarepa is the word yogi. He was a yogi, or yogin in Sanskrit. And this means that he was somebody who was not living in a communal institution, following a lot of rules, as the monks would, but nor was he living a household life, earning money, having a job, perhaps being married with children and looking after his children and sending them through university and all that kind of thing. He wasn't doing either of those things. He was effectively leading a full-time practice life, and he was choosing secluded places where he could do this. And informally, a group of disciples would gather around him who would lead that same type of very, very full-on practice life. And also, he would meet people who were monastics, some of them, or who were lay people, and he would teach them as well and give them some advice. But if there was the slightest chance of them freeing themselves from their monastic or lay responsibilities, he would always encourage them to do that, you know, if they could do so without causing harm to other people, of course. So he was a yogin, and many of his songs celebrate the life of the yogin. So to one of his disciples, who we'll meet in the talk in a couple of days in more detail, he says, when asked in a way to explain himself, he says, "I'm a yogi who lives on the snow mountain peak. I feel naught but joy. Renouncing all turmoil and fondness for diversion, I reside alone in perfect ease. Forswearing the bustle of the world, joyfully I stay in no man's land. Since I've left embittered family life, I no longer have to earn and save. Since I want no books, I don't intend to be a learned man. Since I practice virtuous deeds, I feel no shame of heart. Since I have no pride or vanity, I renounce with joy the saliva-splashing debate. Hypocrisy I have not, nor pretension. Happy and natural I live, without forethought or adjustment. Since I want no fame nor glory, rumours and accusations disappear. Where'er I go, I feel happy. Whatever I wear, I feel joyful. Whatever food I eat, I am satisfied. I am always happy." Isn't that wonderful? And he says this kind of thing over and over again. I mean, he'll also sometimes say, "Tears pour down my face with grief when I think of such and such," and we'll come across some examples of that. But even in his grief, he's happy. I don't know if that makes sense. That might be something to sort of talk about. You know, what is happiness like? What does it mean to be really happy? Even in his grief, he is actually happy. Even if he's starving or ill, he's still happy. And there's a particular kind of happiness, I think, which he represents, which is quite a lesson for us as human beings. Now, I'm not going to go through these songs line by line. I'm going to give you quite a lot. So just listen to them. Don't try and write them down because they're on the handout. But just listen to the songs and take them in. And I may say a few words about the setting or about maybe sometimes about the meaning. But on the whole, I'll just let them speak for themselves, which they do. On the whole, they're incredibly clear. They're very, very plain. Now, on one occasion, some of his disciples tried to persuade him to move down into the village with them. And they said, look, you're enlightened. You don't need to be sitting in a cave meditating anymore. Come and live in the village. Don't worry, we'll look after you, you know. And this is what he said. Practicing meditation in solitude is in itself a service to the people. Although my mind no longer changes, in the sense that it's no longer prey to the worldly winds, it's still a good tradition for a great yogi to remain in solitude. So you might want to think about that. How could somebody living up in caves in the mountains claim to be of service to the people? It seems outrageous, doesn't it, really? So that might be an interesting thing to ponder. And he carries on with this song, which is a good first example of one of his strong metaphor or allegory songs, where he talks about very often about animals or natural phenomenon and so on. The great lioness of the upper snow mountain poses proudly on the summit of the peak. She is not afraid. Proudly dwelling on the mountain is the snow lion's way. The queen vulture on red rock stretches her wings in the wide sky. She's not afraid of falling. Flying through the sky is the vulture's way. In the depths of the great ocean darts the queen of fish, glittering. She's not afraid of drowning. Swimming is the fish's way. On the branches of the oak trees, agile monkeys swing and leap. They're not afraid of falling. Such is the wild monkey's way. Under the leafy canopy of the dense wood, the striped tiger roams and swiftly runs. Not because of fear or worry. This shows her haughty pride, and it is the mighty tiger's way. In the wood on Singer Mountain here, I, Milarepa, meditate on voidness. Not because I fear to lose my understanding, but constant meditation is the yogi's way. And he goes on at the end of this song, he says, I, the cotton-clad, have sung many songs, not to amuse myself by singing sophistries, but for your sake, faithful followers who assemble here, from my heart I've spoken words helpful and profound. And on another occasion, a very well-dressed young girl bumps into him as he's wandering around asking for food in a village. And she asks him about his family, you know, the usual polite question, you know, who is your family? And this is his rather strong, uncompromising response. At first, and I should say this in a way is to do with renunciation, and renunciation is one of his big themes. And it'd be very interesting to listen to this and ponder it for oneself, because renunciation, that is giving up things that you feel are important to you, but which are yet not the most important things. It's giving up the less important things for the sake of the more important things. And this is quite an issue, really. You know, to what extent does one need to do it? To what extent might one make a mistake in doing it? And Milarepa takes it to quite a big extent. He says, at first, my experiences in samsara seemed most pleasant and delightful, samsara being ordinary life, cyclic life. Later, I learnt about its lessons. In the end, I found it a devil's prison. These are my thoughts and feelings on samsara, so I made up my mind to renounce it. At first, one's girlfriend is like a smiling angel. Later, she turns into a fierce, exasperated woman. But in the end, a demoness is she. These are my thoughts and feelings on companions, so I made up my mind to renounce a girlfriend. At first, the sweet little baby smiles, a babe of heaven. Later, he makes trouble with the neighbours. In the end, he is my creditor and my foe. These are my thoughts and feelings about having children. So I renounced both sons and nephews. At first, money is like the wish-fulfilling gem. Later, one cannot do without it. In the end, one feels like a penniless beggar. These are my thoughts and feelings about money. So I renounced both wealth and goods. When I think about these experiences, I cannot help but practice Dharma. When I think of Dharma, I cannot help but offer it to others. When death approaches, I shall then have no regrets. So, we've had a look at the picture of Milarepa's life and his description of that life as his natural life, just like the vulture in the sky or the lion in the forest or the fish in the ocean. And then we've looked at his renunciation, which he describes in personal terms. It's interesting, isn't it? He says, he's not laying it on the others, he's just saying, this is my response, you know, these are my feelings about these things. And so the next little heading I've got is commitment, is his suggestion of the value of committing yourself to practicing the Dharma. And this one comes from one of the most moving and beautiful of all the stories, and one that you'll often see in pictures of Milarepa. People love doing pictures of Milarepa's life story, and this one in particular, I don't know if anyone's ever seen one. You'll see Milarepa sitting in the mouth of a cave, and on one side of him, there is a deer lying down. On the other side of him, there's a huge mastiff, a dog, lying down. And in front of him, there's a man kneeling in front of Milarepa with bow and arrows. And this is the story of Milarepa's meeting with the hunter and the deer. And I'll just briefly say what happens. It's a lovely little story, but what happens is Milarepa hears barking. Down in the valley below. And he climbs on top of a rock and sits on the rock and just waits there. And before long, he sees this terrified deer, a black deer covered with beautiful little cream spots, rushing up through the valley, panting, sweating, wild-eyed. And when he sees the deer, he starts to sing. And he sings this beautiful song. And the deer is attracted to him. And it licks his feet and lies down on one side. So, of course, before long, the barking gets louder, and this huge hunting dog bounds up towards him, drooling with its eyes flashing, you know, and with a huge, horrible snarl on its face. And Milarepa starts singing another song, and this beautiful singing. And the dog is entranced, and gradually the dog's anger, because the dog's spotted the deer, but it's a bit scared of Milarepa, the dog's anger subsides, and the dog goes up to Milarepa, licks his knees, and lies down calmly on the other side. A few moments later, up runs this hunter, the dog's owner, with his bow and his arrow ready notched, to kill the deer that he's hoping his dog has brought to bay. And he sees this weird green-coloured man sitting there with on one side a deer lying placidly, on the other side his dog. And the hunter, Milarepa, of course, sings, as usual, but the hunter is a little bit less easy to entrance. And the hunter is extremely annoyed. And he tells Milarepa so, and he thinks that Milarepa has cast a spell on his dog or something. He says, give me my dog back. You know, that's my dog, that is. And in the end, he's so angry, he actually fires an arrow at Milarepa. And for the first time, he says later that he's never missed. But the arrow flies harmlessly over Milarepa's head. And Milarepa changes tack, and instead of singing beautifully, he sings a song of admonishment and a song of teaching to the hunter. And after a while, it does get through, and gradually the hunter listens And he says, you've got plenty, Milarepa says to the hunter, you'll have plenty of time to shoot me later if you want to. I'm just going to sing you a little song. And the hunter actually goes and looks in Milarepa's cave. And that's the real turning point. He looks in Milarepa's cave, and there's pretty much nothing there. And the hunter is very impressed by this hermit who has pretty much nothing. And Milarepa teaches him, and he does become one of his heart sons, as Milarepa calls his closest disciples later on, the hunter Repa. Repa meaning the cotton-clad one. And this is a little extract from part of his teaching, just a short one. Your unskillfulness hurts no one but yourself. Among 100 heads you value most your own. In all 10 fingers, if one is cut, you feel the pain. Among all things you value, yourself is valued most. The time has come, O hunter, for you to help yourself. Life flees fast. Soon death will knock upon your door. It is foolish, therefore, one's devotion to postpone. So he appeals to his self-interest, says, you need this, you really need this. And so we'll now go into some of Milarepa's teachings. I'll give you another little example, first of all, of his use of metaphor, just a short one. And in this occasion, he's wandering down, looking for a bit of food in the village, and all the villagers are busy building a house. And they say, come on, you lazy bugger, give us a hand, you know, we've got a lot of work to do here. Because especially when Milarepa lays down on the ground and looks at the clouds, this annoys them intensely. And he says to them, I'm already building a house, actually. And they say, oh, that's interesting. He usually does this kind of allegory. And they say, what do you mean you're building a house? You're not doing anything. Faith is the firm foundation of my house. Diligence forms the high walls. Meditation makes the huge bricks. And wisdom is the great cornerstone. With these four things, I build my castle. And it will last as long as the truth eternal. Your worldly houses are delusions, mere prisons for the demons. And so I would abandon and desert them. And here's his exhortation for genuine practice of the Dharma. If one's mind does not accord with the Dharma, what's the use of joining the order? If the poisonous snake of klesha, the five kleshas are known as the five poisons, and they're the five primary negative emotions. If the poisonous snake of klesha is not killed, the yearning for wisdom only leads to fallacy. If venomous jealousy is not overcome, one's yearning for the Bodhi mind will be an illusion. The Bodhi mind, the mind set on enlightenment for the sake of all beings. If one refrains not from hurting people, one's longing for respect and honour is merely wishful thinking. If one cannot conquer ego, clinging and prejudice, one's craving for the wisdom of equality only brings wrong views. And then his teaching on vigilance or mindfulness. And this is a nice little story where he spots a pigeon wearing a necklace. And he's very fascinated by this pigeon wearing a necklace. And the pigeon is then joined by seven other pigeons. And he's a bit suspicious of these pigeons. And he says to them, come on, who are you really? And they turn out to be angel maidens of heaven. And they reveal themselves in their true form. They say, well, we came down in the form of pigeons because we were hoping to overhear some teachings. So he teaches them. And he teaches them particularly about mindfulness and vigilance. With self-composure and mindfulness, you should remain serene. Should you meet disagreeable conditions, disturbing to your mind, keep watch upon yourself. Be alert. Keep warning yourself, the danger of anger is on its way. When you meet with enticing wealth, keep watch upon yourself and be alert. Keep a check upon yourself and say, the danger of craving is on its way. should hurtful, insulting words come to your ears. Keep watch upon yourself and be alert. And so remind yourself, hurtful sounds are but delusions of the ear. When you associate with your friends, watch carefully and warn yourself. Let not jealousy in my heart arise. When you're plied with services and offerings and gifts, be alert and warn yourself. Let me beware, lest pride should spring up in my heart. At all times, in every way, keep watch upon yourself. At all times, try to conquer unskillful thoughts within you. Whatever you may meet in your daily doings, you should contemplate its void and illusory nature. Were even 100 saints and scholars gathered here, more than this they could not say. May you all be happy and prosperous. May you all, with joyous, joyful hearts, devote yourselves to the practice of the Dharma. And what you'll find with Milarepa is that he teaches basic Buddhism. You know, I don't know, just listening to that, that is just basic Buddhism. The Buddha would have taught it himself. And it's one of the things that you do notice when you look at the great Buddhist teachers. At first, you may be, as it were, attracted, distracted. You may notice the differences between their life and their approach and the language they use. But actually, when you look more deeply into it, you'll find nearly always there is the Dharma. The same Dharma that Shakyamuni taught in 500 BC in India is being taught by Milarepa 1500 years later in Tibet, and I hope is being taught by Buddhists 1000 years after that here in the West as well. So you do find it. You find it's there again, that base, and it's quite a delightful recognition. I mean, maybe at first you're slightly disappointed. You think, oh, I was hoping something a bit new, actually, you know. And he's just talking about mindfulness. But actually, you know, when you really think about it, you think, actually, I'm glad about that. Yeah, I'm glad he stresses the importance of mindfulness, of watching your mental states, of being alert for those unskillful states that are enticed into being by particular situations, learning what those situations are and really watching. And indeed, he talks more about ethical practice. It's very difficult sometimes to listen to ethical teachings because they sound so ordinary and slightly, you know, boring in a way. So see if you can listen to this bit. It's not very long. A good Buddhist is one who conquers all bad dispositions. Kindness is toleration of slanders. To be modest is to gain fame and popularity. To maintain pure discipline is to do away with pretense and concealment. To live with a sage is to gain improvement. To be indifferent is the way to stop all gossip. To be good and compassionate is to advance one's Bodhi mind. These are the things that a wise man should do. And more specifically, looking at ethics, is the first precept. And he was very, very keen on the first precept of kindness. We've already seen his approach to the deer and the dog, where he saved the deer from the dog, and he saved the dog from the hunter, and he saved the hunter from himself. And there's one occasion when he's in the town, and it's a market day, and all the butchers have gathered. And there's actually, of course, the butchers then, it's not all wrapped up in polythene and in the freezer compartments. This is rows of cattle waiting to be slaughtered, blood running down the streets, terrified animals, and all this kind of thing. And this is his response as he looks at the butchers. Looking upward to the path of liberation, how can one feel aught but sorrow for these unskillful men, these poor men? How foolish and sad it is to indulge in killing, when by good luck and karma one has a human birth. How sad it is to do an act that in the end will hurt oneself. How sad it is to build a sinful wall of meat made of one's dying parents' flesh. How sad it is to see meat eaten and blood flowing. How sad it is to know confusions and delusions fill the minds of men. How sad it is to find but vice, not love, in people's hearts. How sad it is to see that blindness veils all men who cherish unskillful deeds. Craving causes misery, while worldly deeds bring pain. With this in mind, one feels sorrowful, and thinking thus, one searches for a cure. So the talking of the animals as parents, of course, is the Tibetan idea that in order to encourage more metta, you can reflect on millions of rebirths and think that we've all had every conceivable relationship with each other in past lives. This is the Tibetan method. I don't know if it works for us really, but you can try it. And so when you see somebody and start getting annoyed with somebody, or even if you see an animal that's about to be slaughtered, you reflect, mummy, or you know, this was my wife or my partner in some previous life, or my child, you know. And Milarepa also taught the path, and one of the main path teachings in Tibetan Buddhism is the six perfections, the six paramitas. And he was living in a place called the Small Tamarisk Forest, and there he was visited by a scholar monk who asked him to explain the perfections. The six paramitas contain all Buddhist teachings. To those who practice the Dharma, wealth is but a cause of diversion. He who gives his wealth away will be born a prince of heaven. Noble it is to practice charity, giving the first perfection. The second perfection, moral discipline, is a ladder to liberation, which neither monks nor laymen can discard. All Buddhist followers should practice moral discipline. The third perfection, Buddhist patience, by the patience preacher, that is the Buddha, exemplified, is the virtue which the Buddha cherished most. It's a garment difficult to wear, yet all merits grow when it is worn. And then the fourth perfection, diligence or energy. Diligence is the short path to freedom and a necessity for Dharma practice. Without it, nothing can be done. Ride then upon the horse of diligence. These four dharmas, these first four perfections, bring merit to men, being indispensable for all. Now I will speak of wisdom. A meditation is a teaching between these two. So meditation is the fifth perfection, wisdom is the sixth. Meditation is a teaching between these two, as it applies both to wisdom and to merit practice. By it, all distractions are overcome. For all Buddhist practice, it is most important to meditate. Wisdom paramita is the teaching of final truth, the dearest treasure of all Buddhas. Enjoy wisdom, then, without exhaustion. It's the wish-fulfilling gem of heaven, fulfilling the hopes of all sentient beings. To those who can renounce busy activities, wisdom paramita will bring final rest. The provision of wisdom is most precious, whereby one will reach perfection step by step. Now, tomorrow I'm going to look at, in a bit more detail, at Milarepa's relationship with one or two or three of his disciples, and a little bit more sort of connected stories of how it went with them. And I will talk more about his approach to meditation teaching and his approach to the transmission of wisdom tomorrow. So I won't say much more about that. So not tomorrow, the day after tomorrow. Yes, sorry. Just one little piece on meditation, though. One should turn, this is not a song, this is a prose bit. One should turn all one's Buddhist knowledge inside one's mouth. And I think when he says that, one should turn all Buddhist knowledge inside one's mouth. In other words, instead of telling everybody else, you turned it into yourself. That's what he means by that. So if you do have some knowledge of Buddhism, apply it to yourself, he's saying. So one should turn all one's Buddhist knowledge inside one's mouth and then meditate. If one does not further one's studies and meditation at the same time, but thinks that one should learn a great deal first before starting the actual practice, one will be completely lost. Because knowledge is infinite, and there is no possibility of mastering it all. And I can relate to this. You know, it's so tempting to keep on getting more and more information, reading more and more books, hearing more and more talks, all that kind of thing, and thinking, yes, when I've really got it, then I'll get down to real serious practice. And the last theme I want to give you a song from is one of Milarepa's many songs of transiency. Impermanence was the thing that he felt really deeply himself, how everything passes, and you have to make use of that impermanence. You have to ride the horse of impermanence. And it's also something that he really wanted other people to take on board. And in this case, he was on his way to a remote cave in the snow mountains. And so he was leaving the village, and all his patrons and disciples got together, and they decided to throw him a huge party. So there was this big party, loads of food, dancing, all sorts of things going on. And at the end of the party, they said, could you give us some advice? And he sang to them the song of transience with 8 similes. Listen, he says, to these parables and metaphors. A painting in gold, flowers of turquoise blue, floods in the vale above, rice in the vale below, abundance of silk, a jewel of value, the crescent moon, and a precious sun. Those are the 8. These are the 8 similes. No one has sung this before. No one can understand their meaning if he doesn't listen carefully to the whole song. The gold painting, it fades when it is completed. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. The lovely flowers of turquoise blue are destroyed in time by frost. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice Dharma. The flood sweeps strongly down the vale above. Soon it becomes weak and tame in the plain below. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. Rice grows in the vale below. Soon with a sickle it will be reaped. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. Elegant silken cloth. Soon with a knife it is cut. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. The precious jewel that you cherish, soon it will belong to others. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. The pale moonbeams soon will fade and vanish. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. A precious son is born. Soon he is lost and gone. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. These are the 8 similes I sing. I hope you will remember and practice them. Affairs and business will drag on forever, so lay them down and practice now the Dharma. If you think tomorrow is the time to practice, suddenly you find that life has slipped away. Who can tell when death will come? Ever think of this and devote yourselves to Dharma practice.